This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up later in the show, please press 1 for conversation about call centers. You may love to hate them, but they're big business in Connecticut and around the globe. WNPR's Jeff Cohen has been covering the call centers profiting from the new health exchange. But first, over the last several weeks, Jeff has also been covering another story unfolding here in the city of Hartford. It involves the city treasurer, a man hired to handle city insurance, and nearly $700,000 in missing taxpayer money. Almost every day, it seems there's some new detail. And Jeff joins us now to get the latest. Jeff Cohen, welcome back to Where We Live.
Good morning, John.
If you want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live. And as always, you can find our stories online at wnpr.org. Again, join us, especially if you've been following this ongoing story that has to do with the city treasurer and a man hired to handle city business. Jeff, you've been on this for the last several weeks, and there's a lot of different things happening. Maybe you can take us back to the beginning of this story.
Sure. It begins, John, when folks at the city schools noticed, which is not a small notice, but noticed that the city had paid an insurance broker about $670,000, actually paid him more than that, but in this case, $670,000 to then pay an insurance premium on the city's behalf, in fact, two insurance premiums, and that money was never paid. That got people curious at the schools because the schools essentially and the city share some insurance policies. And they started looking into why that money wasn't paid and then some of the relationships that were involved. The broker in question is a guy named Earl O'Garrow. He runs an agency called Hybrid Insurance Group. And what grew some concern at the schools department was that he has some ties to the family of city treasurer Adam Cloud. He rented office space from the Cloud family in downtown Hartford, and he hired city treasurer Adam Cloud's brother, Chris, to be his lobbyist at the state. We should say that lobbying helped Mr. O'Garrow get about $100,000 in state money to move his office to Hartford from Windsor.
Okay, so let's just back up quickly. So Earl O'Garrow's office was in Windsor. Mm. He gets money from the state to move his office downtown.
That's right.
Into a building that is owned by the Cloud family.
That's right.
Okay. And so he comes downtown. The schools notice some of these things going on. The $670,000, I think, that a lot of people will be wondering about in a city like Hartford that always has budget problems. I think the first question for you is, Jeff, what do we know about where that money is? And did the city ever lose its insurance because of this action?
So the best news out of this whole story is that the city never lost its insurance, that it's always been in place. And that has to do with the fact that the city actually paid the person responsible for paying the premium. So it doesn't have any sort of liability in that case. It still has these excess and umbrella policies in place, and that's not a problem. The problem is that we don't know where that $670,000 is, and that's really a problem for the insurance companies who still have to insure the city without the premiums that they haven't been paid. And what we learned later is, as this story developed, the state insurance department started looking into it, and they filed eventually an 11-count complaint against Mr. O'Garrow and his agency, saying that he has had similar problems with other agencies. He's not paid other bills. He's formed allegedly formed fake companies to help do this. And meanwhile, he's having lots of personal financial problems as well. This is all breaking down over the summer. At the same time that he was having trouble paying the city's insurance premiums, he was having trouble paying a lot of other things, paying his rent to the Cloud family, for instance, paying for his house in Marlborough, which is now under foreclosure. So it's sort of, for him, certainly financially, it's a perfect storm of bad news.
And so that bad news means that private individuals are coming after him. Essentially, they want money that he owes. And now there's a broader investigation into this, and this is how this is really broken open into something that a lot more people are paying attention to. There have been a series of different investigations, but the big one is a federal grand jury investigation.
That's right. And to back up, just to be clear, we mentioned the state filed an 11-count complaint, the insurance department. They've since revoked his insurance license. So the idea, this is his business, right? The idea that he could somehow make money to pay off old debts doesn't seem likely, right? But you're right, John. We know that federal prosecutors and FBI agents have served subpoenas on the city, on the Board of Education, if I recall correctly, and on two state departments to learn more about Hybrid Insurance's business dealings with the state and with the city. And when you see these the requests for information that they've submitted, they're pretty broad, and they have to do with all of Hybrid's business with the city and with the state, but also specifically they want communications between certain people, the superintendent of schools, the head of the school board, city treasurer Adam Cloud, emails concerning his brother, Christopher Cloud, who was Hybrid's lobbyist. So there's lots of it's a fairly broad scope of information that they're looking for to help them figure out if this is a problem that is, A, unique to Mr. O'Garrow. This is one guy who just ran into financial problems on his own, independent of anybody else, or if there's something else that could bring this to a higher level for federal prosecutors, which is the suggestion that maybe he got this business because of some special favors that he may have been getting from the city.
Jeff Cohen covers Hartford for WNPR, and he's been looking into an ongoing now investigation that the federal government is doing into the city of Hartford, some missing money and connections potentially between the city treasurer and Earl O'Garrow. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, if you've been following this story, Jeff.
It's important to say, though, John, that in all of this, we've mentioned city treasurer Adam Cloud, but we've not said his position yet. In all of this, he's denied any allegations of wrongdoing from the very beginning. There's a lot of things that are unclear about his role. He says no quid pro quo, because he didn't hire Hybrid Insurance. That the city hired, or the pension commission hired, another agency that then went and hired Hybrid as its subcontractor. So he's long denied any allegations of wrongdoing, and that's worth noting.
It is worth noting. He has, however, in the past, written letters on behalf of Earl O'Garrow. He's actually clearly knows Earl O'Garrow to some extent. What can you tell us about what we know about their relationship?
Well, what we know, we mostly know from emails that we've asked for from the city and gotten. And in those emails, we know that that O'Garrow was introduced to Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra by the city treasurer, by Adam Cloud. We know that they've had dinner, at least that O'Garrow set up dinner and conversation with certain people. That was back in June 2012. And we know that in May 2012, that Cloud wrote O'Garrow a glowing letter of recommendation that said, and I'll quote, "The tenacity, knowledge, and expertise that Hybrid Insurance Group brings to the table is unmatched. The fact that Mr. O'Garrow and his team have moral compasses that are positioned on thinking what is best for the insured is reason enough." So that's a pretty robust letter of recommendation for a guy now who's in some serious hot water.
Of course, I think one way that some might look at that is the city treasurer, who has a high, powerful position, and who's an elected official, by the way, not an appointed official, an elected official in the city of Hartford, deciding to write a nice letter of recommendation for a minority-owned business, trying to give somebody a little bit of a leg up. That's one way to look at it.
And I think that is what Adam might say were he with us today, I shouldn't put words into his mouth, but it wouldn't be surprising if people were looking out for minority-owned businesses in the city.
So Adam Cloud has said that he doesn't have any business dealings with Earl O'Garrow outside of his business with the city. Essentially, Earl O'Garrow hired to handle the city's insurance business. But something else that these emails that you've found has uncovered, that at least on one occasion, they seem to have made a business trip together, or at least that's the suggestion, through a purchase item that you've seen on the city credit card.
That's right. So what we did was when you ask for emails, you get a file and you get a whole slew of them, and you start clicking and clicking and clicking. And one of the clicks led to a receipt for the W Hotel in New York City. I think it was in Union Square. And on the receipt, it was for August 23rd, 2012. On the receipt, it was one room and the guests named on the reservation were Earl O'Garrow and Adam Cloud. So we asked, and for a while didn't get a whole lot of answers in terms of what was happening, what was there. It could be that neither men went. It could be that one man went. So we'd like to know. And it was initially charged to the city. It was initially charged to city treasurer Adam Cloud's city credit card. And then we've been told that it's since been either reimbursed or Mr. O'Garrow paid for it himself. That was back in August 2012. We asked the treasurer for more information. We asked him if it was a business trip. He said yes. We asked him if he would elaborate. He said no. And then eventually he said, "You have to talk to my attorney, a private attorney, not a city attorney, John Droney." And John said two things. One, Adam was in the city on business. And two, Mr. O'Garrow reserved the reservation and charged it to Adam's credit card by mistake. He made that hotel reservation, I should say, and charged it to Adam's credit card by mistake, which doesn't necessarily answer all of the questions. One question is, well, what were they there together? Was this city business that the city treasurer was in town for? And then secondly, how is it that someone who that is a private citizen can charge something to a city credit card by mistake? It doesn't make sense, but we haven't gotten any more. We've asked and not gotten any more answers.
And, of course, the city of Hartford has had in the last year maybe some issues, we should say, about what's been charged to city credit cards. This has been an ongoing problem for different sectors of City Hall. We're talking with Jeff Cohen, WNPR's reporter, who's covering this ongoing investigation into the city of Hartford and what's happening with the treasurer, a man named Earl O'Garrow. And we're trying to learn more each and every day. And just within the last week, Jeff, a few more things have come out. NBC Connecticut, local television station, got what they called an exclusive interview with Earl O'Garrow. We've been trying to get in touch with him. They actually tracked him down. What did he say to the television station?
He was guarded at best is a fair way to describe it. He couldn't really address a lot of the allegations. What he did say specific to this was eventually in the end when the answer comes out, A, he knows where the city's missing money is, and B, he'll tell people, and this won't be so bad in the end. That's what he said. It doesn't exactly soothe a lot of people who I've talked to, because if he knew where the money was, presumably he could pay it and this would not be a problem.
Or it would be less of a problem. And then, of course, speaking of problems, in the intervening days, Earl O'Garrow winds up back in the news for something completely unrelated and something that it was a little bit surprising. He ends up in some sort of a domestic dispute in which police are called.
That's right. State police arrested him, according to the state police docket online and to warrants provided by Kevin Rennie, current columnist Kevin Rennie on his blog, Daily Ructions. And Earl O'Garrow and his wife, Kendra O'Garrow, have gotten into some disputes, and Earl eventually was arrested on various counts. Domestic abuse, domestic cases don't often rise to the level of the sort of thing that we would cover in the regular news cycle. But what makes this relevant is, on the one hand, this is a sort of paints a picture, as we said before, of a guy who's going through some personal financial trouble, apparently. Now, maybe there's an answer to this that resolves all that, and I don't know that. And if so, then I would be wrong. But that's what it certainly looks like. But then if you read some of the statements that are made by his wife to state police, she draws a direct line to this investigation, to the investigation of hybrid insurance, and saying that it's really – I think – I forget the exact words. It's got him agitated to the point where he was, according to her, threatening her. And so this whole situation has gone from a guy who's not paying his bills, he's losing a state license, the federal investigators are interested, and now – it's harming his marriage.
So just the last thing for you, Jeff, before we take our break and move on to our next story here on Where We Live. You know, if you're listening around the state, it may very well strike you that this story, like stories that have come out of Waterbury or Bridgeport or certainly Hartford that you covered around former Mayor Eddie Perez when you were at the Hartford Current, it seems as though there's a drumbeat of these sorts of stories. If I'm listening in some small town elsewhere, not in one of these cities, I guess one question I have, why should I care? Why does it matter so much if there's these sorts of allegations happening in and around City Hall in Hartford?
I think, I guess there's the civics answer, which is, don't we all want to have clean government? But how does it affect you also? Well, it's a hard argument to I think part of it is the civics argument. Part of it is all of these towns that we're talking about. The city of Hartford gets half of its annual operating budget from the state. That's your tax dollars. That's everyone's tax dollars. But more to the point, you can't live in greater Hartford and pretend that Hartford is not relevant to you. You may not live here, but the problems and the challenges and the joys that are Hartford are not entirely Hartford self-contained. People who live here and work here don't just stay here. This is a larger community that transcends the boundaries that were for some reason 100 and some odd, 200 years ago, drawn. And that would be my answer.
Jeff Cohen is WNPR's reporter who's covering this story. And another story that we're going to turn to next, call centers are a big industry all across the United States, especially with the new healthcare exchanges. We'll continue our conversation with Jeff, and we'll also bring in a call center expert. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live.
Thank you for calling Access Health Connecticut. We may monitor or record this call for quality and training purposes. You can always visit our website at www.accesshealthct.com if you have any questions about Access Health Connecticut. If you are calling about your or your family's Husky Health benefits, CHIP benefits, or benefits or services you or your family receives from your local Department of Social Services, press 1. If you are calling with questions...
That's a bit of what you hear when you dial the phone line for Access Health CT. That's the agency that runs the state's new health exchange under Obamacare. As you've heard, the states using the federal government's website aren't doing so well in signing up new customers, but Connecticut's faring pretty well, in part because of the state website, but also because of this call center, which to date has taken around 40,000 calls since October 1st. But who's running that call center? How does it work? We'll be looking at the big business world of call centers this hour. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266, especially if you work in that industry. We'd love to hear from you. You can also email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive. We're continuing on with Jeff Cohen, WNPR's reporter, who's been reporting on call centers and the Affordable Care Act. I want to bring into the conversation Erwin Lazar. He is vice president and service director at Namerti's Research Center. It's a call center industry analyst. And Erwin, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, before I get to a little bit of Jeff's story, that's the sound that we hear when we call a lot of places that have call centers. How typical is that? The female voice recorded that takes you through, in this case, about a minute-long phone tree of questions to get to what you actually want to find out. Is that fairly typical of what you hear?
It's extremely typical, especially for organizations that have to deal with large numbers of calls, because what you want to do is kind of categorize who that caller is, try and identify them if you can, and make sure that you can route them to the right person.
Now, when we played that all the way through to the end, by the time you're done with the last option you have there, it's a minute of phone call time. Is that about right, Erwin, or does that seem a little bit long to you?
It's not unusual. It certainly depends on the kind of organization. You know, we see organizations that try and be a high-touch, high-value type company, like a large financial, for example, that they try and get you right to a live human being because that's a competitive differentiator. But organizations that have to deal with large volumes of calls and potentially large differences in what those people are calling for would often leverage what we call an IVR, integrated voice response, to get you to somebody who can help you, hopefully, as seamlessly as possible.
So I want to turn to Jeff here. Now, when we made that phone call, we actually weren't calling the state of Connecticut. We were calling a company called Maximus, right?
That's right. And let me also say, she sounded exceptionally happy.
Yeah.
She
was very cheery, very
bright.
It was
like she was holding back a giggle, and I enjoyed listening. I hadn't called before. That's right. Presumably, that person works for a company called Maximus. Maximus is the company that the state's exchange, Access Health CT, hired to run its call centers.
So they hired Maximus, I assume, as part of a bidding process, because the state wasn't going to do this themselves. The federal government, of course, running all these different exchanges around the country, they have different call centers. And each state that's running its own Affordable Care Act or its own series of health exchanges, they all have their own call centers.
That's right. And states have done it differently. The state of Oregon, which has had its issues with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. The state of Oregon is one of those states that is implementing its own exchange. It's not part of the federal healthcare.gov exchange system directly. It decided it was going to do its own call center and not subcontract it out. The state of Connecticut said, took a different path and hired the experts, essentially. Hired a company that does this as its business. Not just call centers, and maybe Erwin can speak to this, but specifically sort of government call centers and public service sort of call centers. Because if you think about it, these have existed for a lot of reasons for a long time. Medicaid and Medicare benefits, that sort of thing. You can already call in to get those. And this is an extension and a widening of that service.
It's a widening of the service, but I think something to note here is when you call a government call center, like, for instance, run by the state of Connecticut for one of its departments, I'll throw out the Department of Social Services, they're doing that work, from everything I understand, in-house. In this case, Access Health CT, which is running the state's health exchange, has gone outside of any government agency, and they've hired, as you said, outside experts.
That's right. They've hired outside experts, and we beat this drum a few times, John. We can't know exactly what they've hired them for when it comes to the call center. We can't know their metrics or how much they've paid them, because Maximus has asked Maximus has redacted that information from the publicly available contract. We've filed a complaint with the state's Freedom of Information Commission saying we don't think you can do that, and we'll take that through the process. But what's important to note is that in other states where we have seen similar contracts from Maximus, we know that call centers, when you contract them out, you can make incentives for things that you want. So in Vermont, they get paid a per minute price per phone call. But they also get paid if they pick the phone up and answer a call, essentially, under a certain time, that people aren't on hold too long. They can get incentives if they, you know, if the calls get to a certain stage after a certain time. Obviously, if they're paying a, if they're getting a per minute fee, they make more money the longer you stay on the phone. That's what's happening in Connecticut also. We know that, and in Vermont. But on the flip side, what Kevin Counihan, the head of Access Health CT, has said to this firm is, look, we want you to take the greatest care possible with these people so they can get enrolled in something that's very important, healthcare.
Erwin Lazar, maybe you can talk through a little bit of that. This idea that a call center would be paid per minute, meaning essentially the longer they keep you on hold, or at least that's the way we're viewing it, the longer they keep you on the line, excuse me, the more they would get paid. Does this sound about right? Is this the way a lot work?
No, I think that's actually a little unusual. Typically, when you're defining your call center metrics and what you measure to define success, you're looking at things like how quickly can you resolve the call, how quickly can you get somebody off the phone, how little are they on hold, how short of the time can they navigate through the IVR. So usually you're looking at incentives to try and shorten those calls. And what we see a lot in the commercial side is incentives to push people towards self-help. So, you know, if somebody, you almost want the person to pick up the phone and call as a last resort if they can't, you know, navigate through the website and find the information they need. Obviously, with the Healthcare Exchange website, that's been a little bit of an issue lately.
The difference, John, and tell me if I'm wrong, Erwin, is that in a lot of the commercial stuff, I was speaking with one of the Maximus representatives who essentially said, you know, this is not as easy as, are you having a problem? Have you unplugged your router?
Yeah,
which you can sort of automatedly go through, right? Have you unplugged your router? Have you gone through all these? You need to bring a lot of information to the table when you call. You need to have a lot of your own personal financial information, your own identifying information, information about your family, other policies that you might have in your family, other state coverages that you might bring to the table. So it's a complicated mix of things. It's not as easy as fixing your internet over the phone or paying your credit card bill. And in that case, time is expensive, I suppose, but if you resolve a person's issue on the first call as opposed to on subsequent calls, then that could be a benefit for the state.
Erwin, does that sound about right to you that the sorts of complexities we're dealing with when we have a call center that's trying to enroll people in a brand new health exchange, that's a heck of a lot different than just calling up and saying my bill's wrong on my cell phone for my cell phone?
Sure, it definitely is more complex, but I think, again, if you look at the trend in the financial world and related, both insurance and finance, you know, the trend is to push people into using the website. So the websites like, I don't know if I could say a specific name, but someone like a LendingTree, where you can go on and fill in all that information up front, and then if you run into a problem, you pick up the phone, you call an agent, and that agent can look and say, oh, okay, I see where you got stuck. Let's take it from here. That's the kind of customer service that we see in the commercial space that organizations are trying, versus having somebody pick up the phone right away and call in and then take a much longer, much more expensive path to completing the goal of the call.
And what Erwin's saying mimics exactly what I've heard from folks at the state, which is, look, the real way we'd really like you to do it is the website. But we know that there are, because we're talking about a program that will involve the entire population of the state of Connecticut age-wise, and not everyone is comfortable putting all of their information, say, on a computer, or not everyone has a computer, not everyone's computer savvy, and they might prefer to make the phone call. But obviously, and he's right, the most efficient way to do it, the most cost-effective way, is to go through the website. It also minimizes a lot of errors that can happen because it's a very prescripted process online.
We're talking with Jeff Cohen, who's WNPR's reporter who covers health and the Affordable Care Act for us. Erwin Lazar is also here. He is a call center industry analyst. He's vice president and service director at Nemertes Research Center. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. If you have experience with call centers in our state or you have any questions about the way they work, we'd like to hear from you. 860-275-7266. Just a little bit, we'll be talking a bit more about the employment picture, not only here in Connecticut, but also nationwide. So, Erwin, one of the things that Jeff just said makes me want to ask you about the way call centers might be changing with the web. So many companies want us to do all of the work online. They don't want us interacting with a live human. Has it changed the call center business substantially in just the last couple of years?
Yeah, it has. And then another thing that, Jeff mentioned was that you have a lot of people who may not have computers and want to call in. We see one of the big challenges for people that are building call centers today is different desires from different generations of individuals. So the younger generation, they want to do everything on their mobile phone. And if they've got to pick up the phone and call somebody, they've probably decided, you know, if it's if there's a substitute, I'm going to go to another company that has, you know, a better mobile app. We talked a lot about people wanting to use the web. So what's really happening in the contact center space is organizations trying to figure out how do you unite all of those different channels so that I can know who a customer is no matter which way they come in, whether they're coming in through a mobile app, the web, even a social network because they sent a tweet out and asked for help that way. And that's really where we call it multi-channel or now omni-channel is where a lot of the investment in the vendor community as well as in some of the leading customer service organizations is going towards being able to unify all the different ways that you can interact with a customer.
Talk a bit more about some of the new technologies. Are there new things that call centers are able to do to find out a little bit more about us, or internal technologies that may be transparent to the customer but are really revolutionizing this business?
Yeah, I think one really cool one is something called virtual IVR, or visual IVR, I should say. So think about what we heard at the beginning of the segment where somebody had to press 1, press 2, press 3, enter their account number, and so on and so on. And as you said, it was a minute to get through that. If I can do all of that through a website or a mobile app, and then when I get to the endpoint, then I click call, and that call automatically routes me in, it's probably a little bit easier for me to use, and then I don't have to sit and, you know, punch in all these numbers. So that's one, I think, really interesting area. Again, the unification of text chat. So if I get to a point on a website where I need help, I can chat with somebody live and say, help me here. And then if I get to a point where I really need to talk to someone, I can click and either get directly through to an agent, or I can go into a queue and have that agent call me back when they're available. Another really interesting technology we're looking at is something called WebRTC, which would enable you to make a phone call through your browser. So, again, if I'm in a website and I want to talk to an agent, I can actually click a button and call through my computer without having to then drop out, dial an 800 number, and navigate through an IVR that way.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We'll get to some of your calls in a moment. Maybe you have stories about really bad experiences with call centers. I'm sure we've all had them. One of the things, Erwin, that is interesting, though, with all the technology, there will always be an impetus. People will want to talk to a human. And I guess I'm wondering if you can talk to us about what you've learned in this business about how best to make that interface happen. Because I have to tell you, when I get through to someone who understands my problem and sounds, as Jeff said before, somewhat happy, not too happy, but somewhat happy and empathetic toward me, it changes my entire relationship with a company. And I have some very bad relationships with companies as a consumer when I can't get through to a real person or I'm always forced to the web. Is there still something to that human element?
Yeah, you know, I think there is. And, you know, one of the really interesting areas that we're watching in our research is how companies are measuring the success of their customer engagement. Typically, you looked at some of the things we talked about earlier, like first call resolution, how long did somebody wait on hold, and you looked at metrics that you could apply to a phone call. But now what companies are looking at is, what was the customer perspective? Did they feel like they got the right amount of service? Would they recommend us using something called a Net Promoter Score? How do they respond in a post-call survey, and how did they rate the interaction? So that's one thing that starts to look at you know, what else? What's the customer point of view of that call? And then you start going back and looking at, do I have trained agents? Are they friendly? Are they reading from the right script? All the things that are perceived from the customer as you mentioned, being an effective communication channel.
Of course, reading from the right script and friendly humans is very important. In the next segment, we're going to be talking with someone who's part of a communications workers union. They've been pushing hard to keep call center jobs here in the United States. I mean, what can you tell us, Erwin, about the reaction of consumers when they know that their call to their domestic, cell phone carrier is quite obviously routed to someplace else in the world where somebody is speaking with a very clear accent from someplace else, somebody is very clearly not in the United States. Does that have an impact on consumers, or does that just not matter to us anymore?
I think, again, it's somewhat generational. It also depends on the problem. If you can get that problem resolved, generally you're not going to care all that much who you're talking to. There are some trust issues, especially if you're thinking about things like healthcare or finance or so on, of who you're giving your personal information to. But I think overall, the biggest thing that we see that people want is that, you know, if I've just spent 15 minutes doing something on a website, I don't want to have to repeat myself. I don't want to have to say, you know, okay, here's my account number, here's my name, here's what I'm trying to do. And, you know, if you can link the different channels that, you can interact with your customers together, so that when that person answers the call, regardless of where they're located, they can say, you know, hi, Mr. Smith, I see you're a platinum member with us. I see you're trying to update your billing information. Let's figure out how to get that through. That's what I think makes for effective customer service, again, regardless of where the location of the person receiving the call is.
When we were reading through some of your writing about this, Irwin, there's a term that I frankly am not very familiar with, and maybe you can explain. What is the Internet of Things?
So the Internet of Things is basically everything in the world starting to be connected to the Internet. Case in point, your refrigerator has a compressor starts to fail. That refrigerator connected to the Internet sends a message to the company that made your refrigerator, who then calls you and says, hey, we understand, you know, you're having a problem with your refrigerator. We'd like to send out a technician and get that resolved. Now, that could be something offered under warranty or something offered as a paid service, but that kind of information is going to quickly flood contact centers, and you're going to see a lot more outbound dialing or outbound calling of contact centers, where the agents aren't just sitting there waiting for calls to come in, but they're proactively calling out to people and saying, you know, we understand your air filter is clogged on your car, or you know, again, your heating system is due for a tune-up. You know, all those kinds of things that you begin to see made available.
Just turning back to healthcare quickly before we have to take a break, Jeff Cohen, as I said earlier, so far to date, since the October 1st rollout of the new health exchanges here in Connecticut, they're reporting some 40,000 or so calls answered at the call center, a total number of applications completed at just around 7,500 under private insurance, about 5,500 under Medicaid. Of course, we don't know from the breakdown how many of those got through the call center, how many got through the state website. Anything else you think that we're going to learn moving forward, aside from maybe potentially the price of what Maximus is getting paid to answer these calls?
Well, when it comes to call centers, I think I did a story on this a couple of weeks ago. I'm wondering if call centers will slowly have a less of a role once we get past this first wave, in the Affordable Care Act, I should say. As we get past this first wave, as the websites sort of learn to flex their muscle a little bit, Connecticut's website really hasn't had a whole lot of problem. It did early on. Every now and when the federal websites have problems, it affects us, but not too terribly much. And I should also note, John, that it's worth noting that as federal websites have had all the problems that they have had collectively, the state of Connecticut has enrolled, as of a couple weeks ago, like 10% of all the people in the country who had enrolled in the Affordable Care Act had enrolled in Connecticut, and the call center is part of that.
Irwin Lazar, before I let you go, some of the things that you've said suggest to me that there may be a future for the call center business in which not a whole lot of humans are really working there. You might not need a whole bunch of people answering calls if people can get their questions answered through some sort of voice recognition or, you know, my refrigerator talking directly to the company. It seems as though the human element may be phased out over the course of the next couple of decades. What do you think?
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I think there's definitely, if you look at the generational trends, the younger generation, the ones that are spending a lot more time on mobile devices than I ever did, are expecting to get their help that way. They're either you know, expecting that the app that they're using can help them, or that they can go to a customer community and get support. So we see a lot of investment in community. But I think there's always going to be human element, especially in complex sales. We talk about healthcare, talk about the Internet of Things, and think about the medical sensors that will likely be connected into a call center that would call you when there's an issue with blood pressure or a heart rate or whatever. I think there's always going to be a role for humans. There's certainly a lot of opportunities to specialize and provide additional training for what those humans can handle.
Can I just ask a question? Are we supposed to try and keep hitting zero until we get to the human? It seems like we were talking about this before we came in. We always just keep hitting zero so we can get to the operators, like operator, operator. But it seems like do call centers strategize around that behavior?
Yes, they do. I've talked to a lot of organizations that have different philosophies. One that really tries to keep you in the IVR and only lets you dump out as a last resort, and others that want to give you every opportunity to go and talk to a human because, again, they think that's a competitive differentiator if you can get through to a live human. And you see it in some advertising where companies will highlight the fact that a live human being will answer the call before the second ring, and we won't put you through the pain of an IVR.
I will tell you this. I have dropped credit cards because they don't let me talk to humans. It's actually that simple. I'm just one person, but credit card companies, if you're listening, I'm that guy. Erwin Lazar is a call center industry analyst. He's vice president and service director at Nemertes Research Center. Erwin, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Jeff Cohen, who covers the Affordable Care Act and also the city of Hartford for us here at WNPR. Thanks so much, Jeff.
You're welcome, John.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more about the call center business. It is big business all around the country and all around the globe, of course. Of course, it's big business all around the globe because a lot of U.S. jobs are being outsourced. We're going to be talking about legislation trying to stop that and about how many people are actually employed in the call center business here in Connecticut. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You always talk to a live person right here on the radio on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, another chapter in the political scandal that derailed former House Speaker Chris Donovan's congressional campaign has now come to a close. One of the key figures in that case was sentenced earlier this week. Our political roundtable, The Wheelhouse, will discuss this. Also, we'll look at what the Obamacare delay might mean for Connecticut. And will Foxwoods actually get a new casino in Massachusetts? Those are some of the stories in The Wheelhouse tomorrow. I hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about call centers in the program. A group of lawmakers are now trying to make it harder for companies to outsource these jobs, proposing legislation that would put companies on a public list, send substantial portions of their customer service work overseas. They wouldn't be eligible for certain grants and loans. The bill would require overseas call agents to disclose their names and locations. Joining us now to talk more about this is Chuck Porcari. He's spokesperson for the Communications Workers of America. They've been working with lawmakers on this piece of legislation. Chuck, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
First of all, and we're going to get to a phone call or two in a moment at 860-275-7266 from our callers who want to know more about call centers. We hear from you folks that there are about 50,000 call center jobs in Connecticut. That seems like a lot of jobs.
Absolutely. And that number is down from over 55,000 in 2006, which is about 11% or so decline. And these are good family supporting jobs. I mean, these are in the $35,000 to $50,000 a year range. And these are good, solid jobs with benefits that are being offshored rapidly.
I want to get to the phones here. If you want to join us as we talk about call centers, 860-275-7266. Derek's calling from Windsor. Hi, Derek. You're on Where We Live.
How are you, John? As usual, good job.
Thank you, sir. What's on your mind?
I first want to say, if it's not troubling the way we are moving away from the way how we usually communicate, and I understand technology and all that kind of stuff. That's one of my questions. And the second one is, what about people that are not so savvy with computer? Is there a concern about those folks? And, even my daughter today, with the way how she talked to me, is by texting, and I find it real troubling because I think it's more comforting when you communicate with people. And again, like I said, I understand that technology is taking over. So that's my real concern.
Well, Derek, thank you as always for your phone call. And Chuck, I'm sure that you hear a lot of people talking about these very issues. The idea, first of all, that they want to talk to a human being whenever they call up their credit card company or their phone company. But also this other very important idea that we didn't talk about in the last segment, but I think is vital. There are an awful lot of folks who aren't necessarily so technologically savvy, for whom the phone is about the only way they're going to get the information they need.
Derek is absolutely correct, and he builds on a point that Erwin made earlier, that the human element is vital in the customer service interaction. I mean, just for customer satisfaction, for the idea that you are actually being helped by someone other than a machine. And part of what the Communications Workers of America and a bipartisan group, I might add, of lawmakers in Washington are working on this Call Center and Worker Protection Act. Part of this is all about keeping those jobs here and keeping that connectivity here in America.
Okay, so tell me a bit more about what this legislation would do, because we understand legislation like this has been proposed in the past. It has not necessarily gotten all that far. And from what we're hearing from people, I'm not necessarily sure what sort of chance it has in this particular Congress. But that said, it's legislation that is bipartisan. What exactly would it do, Chuck?
Well, basically, it would end taxpayer subsidies for corporations that send U.S. call center jobs offshore. For example, just this year in Shelton, Prudential Financial offshored 40 call center jobs, and that same facility received $12.6 million in taxpayers' incentives. So the idea is A, if you want to move your jobs offshore, I mean, that's business that you're allowed to do that, but you shouldn't be able to do that at the expense of the taxpayers. That's the first part of the legislation. The second part we call the Press One for America section, and it would require call center employees to identify the country from which they're taking the call, and if outside the United States, offer the consumer the opportunity to be transferred back to a facility in the U.S. So it's multi-pronged, and the other part of this, which blends in and is very important, is the data security part, because the fact of the matter is that there are significant enforcement gaps overseas when it comes to individual consumer data security, and that we've had huge issues in the past with data security being leaked, being sold on the open market, and things of that nature.
Okay, so let's pull apart a few of these things, because I think the first piece that you're talking about, whether or not companies can get taxpayer money if indeed they're going to offshore jobs, obviously you'd agree, everyone would agree, companies can do what they want to a certain extent. They're trying to make money for shareholders, and so if they want to offshore jobs, that's their right. But what you're saying in that first piece of this legislation is you don't want them to be able to benefit from tax incentives from the state or federal government.
That's exactly it. And there are numerous cases. For example, T-Mobile USA closed 7 call centers around the country last year, and between those 7 call centers, they had a total of $61 million in taxpayer subsidies, and those just go into the ether. I mean, the money is gone. Once it's promised, it's gone. There are no clawback provisions or things of that nature. So that's a huge problem. Again, and this is separate and distinct from, you know, your business model. If you want to move, that's fine. The fact is, you just can't do it on our dime.
Okay, so the second piece of this is where it gets a little unusual for me, and I want to make sure that I understand this. What you would essentially be requiring is, if companies have overseas call center workers, they would have to identify themselves to the customer. And if I called up and I got somebody from another country, I would be able to then ask for someone in this country?
That's correct. And they would have to identify from which they're taking the call, for India, for example. And then they would have to say, well, I can help you, or if you wish, I can transfer you back to a facility located in the United States.
But if they're being transferred back to a facility in the United States, then somebody in the United States is going to be waiting on hold to take that phone call. And I'll just say, Chuck, obviously you want to preserve American jobs, but that doesn't seem from a financial standpoint to make all that much sense to the company.
Well, again, and I think that's part of the intention of the legislation here. If you, with more than, you know, we've lost over 400,000 call center jobs in this country in the last 10 years. And like I said before, these are good family supporting jobs. You know, there comes a point where, you know, this is going to be like our manufacturing base. I mean, outsourcing, it's just not about manufacturing. It's, you know, they're shifting these jobs overseas. And now, you know, like manufacturing, these jobs are getting moved to facilities overseas. There has to come a point at some point where, you know, the taxpayer finance flight of jobs has to end, and this is the intention of the legislation.
Now that last piece, this piece having to do with data security, this is something else where if you're dealing with, say, a multinational corporation that has offices all across the world, say one of the big credit card companies, to them, the fact that they're doing business in the United States or the UK or India or Indonesia is pretty much transparent, and it should be pretty much transparent to the customer as well. You're saying that there's a suggestion that there may be data breaches if any of this information is taken by someone in a call center overseas?
That's correct. You know, U.S. law may, in fact, protect data when it crosses the borders, but if that data is lost or stolen abroad, that's the difference. A consumer faces huge challenges in dealing with, and there are numerous cases. There was a case in October 2012, and we call it the Scareware case, where tech support scams from Indian and U.S. Call centers, they contacted tens of thousands of consumers, not only in the United States and Australia and Canada, but offering to remove non-existent malware from computers for fees ranging from $49 to $450. So what you're doing is you know, you have these countries overseas, their laws are so different from U.S. law that data becomes hits the open market very easily.
Just a last few things for you, because we are running a little low on time. A lot of this legislation seems to be aimed at punishing companies that might outsource jobs. And from your standpoint, I completely understand why you and some lawmakers would be pushing for this. Is there a way to incentivize companies, to better incentivize companies, as opposed to using the stick, use a little bit of a carrot, to keep these sorts of communications jobs in the States? I mean, what can American workers in this field offer companies that maybe you're not offering yet?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and that is the $64,000 question. But I think the answer is twofold. And first off, it is, you know, at what point do we stop offshoring jobs for labor costs? I mean, at what point do, you know, we think about keep these middle class, do what we have to do to keep middle class jobs in the United States, and then remove them out? You know, we're not trying to deal with the business model here. We're trying to deal with the idea of moving jobs overseas and using taxpayer dollars before they do it.
So before, we've talked about the policy, and we've talked a little bit in our program about how these call centers work. I just want to ask you, Chuck, is this something that you've done in the past? Have you worked in a call center? Have you done this work yourself?
I have not, but the Communication Workers of America, we represent about 150,000 call center workers across the country, and everything from airline reservations to telecommunications, including call centers in Connecticut with our members who work for AT&T and Verizon.
I guess I'm just wondering if you hear from your constituents, the people who work in this industry, whether or not Americans are getting more angry, less angry with call center workers than they used to, because it seems as though we've entered into this era in which people have long wait times, or they have to go through these phone trees that we were talking about before. They can't get the information they want. There's this instant gratification society that we seem to have today. Are you hearing something that's a little bit different from the consumers and when they're talking to these call center workers that you represent?
We are. And a case in point is T-Mobile closed one of the call center in Frisco, Texas, about 8 months ago. And our workers there told us that by the time the calls came to them, they went overseas first, they weren't able to be helped, they bounced back, the consumer was outraged. And they were losing customers on a consistent basis just because of that very frustration. So, again, you know, the idea is A, the taxpayer subsidies, but B, you know, people in the United States should have the opportunity to, you know, be served, you know, in America if they wish. And there's nobody forcing them to do that either.
Do you fear this Internet of Things that we were talking about with Erwin earlier, these new technologies that may render the traditional call center somewhat obsolete in over time, maybe over the next 10 years or so?
Erwin made an excellent point, but also the add-on point that ultimately people want to talk to people. You can, obviously, technology has a role and have a continuing role, but there comes a point where basic human interaction becomes the key to successful customer service, or remains the key.
Are any of the Connecticut lawmakers signed on to this bill that you're pushing?
Not yet, but we have. Last year, with the same bill, there were 130 total from both sides of the aisle. And this year, for the first time, we have Senate sponsorship. Senator Casey and Senator Johnson are sponsoring. And as we speak, the legislation is being passed around the Hill. So we'll be glad to let you know when Connecticut people sign up.
So you're feeling a little bit more confident than you have in the past?
We are. And again, this is bipartisan legislation. The co-sponsors is a Republican, Dave McKinley from West Virginia, and Representative Tim Bishop from Long Island. And again, Senator Casey and Senator Johnson. So the idea that this is on both sides of the Hill is very encouraging.
Chuck Brocard is a spokesperson for the Communication Workers of America. Chuck, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you want to continue the conversation about today's show, go to WNPR.org. You can always send us an email, wherewelive@WNPR.org, and you can tweet us at wherewelive. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives with help from Heather Brandon today. The senior producer is Katie Talarski. Tomorrow, join us in the wheelhouse. We'll be tackling all the news of the week with Colin McEnroe, Mark Pazniokas, and a series of other reporters and guests. I hope you can join us tomorrow on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live.